Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Oh, I have the impossible task of trying to do the book of Habakkuk in one 30-minute lesson. So let's get to it. I'll be going kind of fast. I've given you a detailed outline for that purpose. Follow with me. Now, let's look, first of all, at the prophet himself. Now, Habakkuk, we don't know a lot about him. His name means to caress or embrace. There's even an Assyrian form that we find in the Septuagint that means a table vegetable. Wouldn't that be a great name, table vegetable? We think he may have been a singer in the Levitical choirs because of chapter 3, verse 1 and 19, combined with his use of Selah in chapter 3. Now that brings me to the structure of the book. 1 and 2 are a dialogue between the prophet and God, and chapter 3 is a poetic prayer on God's greatness and control of history, especially the Exodus. Now, in chapters 1 and 2, this prophet forms a uniqueness. Usually, God's prophet stands between God and the people. But this prophet stands between the people and God and speaks toward God for the people. And so we have a structure like this. In verses 2 through 4, Habakkuk complains against God's slowness to punish the wicked. And God's going to respond to him in verses 5 through 11 of chapter 1. Then God's response bothers the prophet more even than his first question, because God's going to use an ungodly nation like the Neo-Babylonians. And so the prophet talks back to God or answers God in chapter 1:12 through 2:1. And then in chapter 2:1 through 5 comes God's second reply. And then he is a series of laments or woes or funeral dirge for Babylon. And that's kind of the outline. 1 and 2 are the dialogue between the prophet and God, and number 3 is that very beautiful poetry about the character of God. Now, many have wondered about the date of this book, and there's much discrepancy. Two dates seem to come to mind more and more. Because the place of the book in the Minor Prophets, and because of the rise of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, the racial group of the Chaldeans, some have asserted this is the reign of Manasseh, 687 through 642 B.C. A much more common and probably more probable date is the reign of Jehoiachin, 609 to 598 B.C. This happened just before Nebuchadnezzar, that's the Neo-Babylonian Empire, was pursuing the remnants of the Assyrian army up the headwaters of the Euphrates. Pharaoh Necho from Egypt came through Palestine, by the way, sacked Jerusalem, and went on up to try to help the Assyrians to keep the balance of power. But Nebuchadnezzar beat the Assyrian army, beat Pharaoh Necho, forced him back way into Egypt, and that's when Palestine came under Neo-Babylonian control. The Battle of Carchemish is what I'm talking about, 605, a very important battle, a turning battle in the who's going to be number one in the Fertile Crescent. Okay? Now, let's look at the book then. The oracle, now this is to lift up. It means to lift up one's voice, or a more traditional understanding is a burden on someone's back. The Lord puts a message on a man's heart. It's a burden to bear until he gives it. Now, how long, O Lord? Look at verse 3. Why dost thou make? Well, here is the prophet questioning God. He's saying, if you really are all-powerful, and if you really are all good, why does the world look like this? You ever feel that way? Or I've prayed and prayed and prayed about this godless things, and you haven't answered. You ever feel like that? Well, that's the way the prophet felt, and I know we do too sometimes, though we know God is in control of history. That's what chapter 3 is all about. Now, look at verse 4. Therefore the law is ignored. Now, the word ignored here means to become cold. And become cold, so cold as to become insensitive. The people had felt that way. Now, the wicked surround the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. Now, that may refer to these godless nations, Assyria, Neo-Babylon later on, or the wicked inside the people of God. It's not sure which. Now, here comes God's first answer. He doesn't answer the prophet's question. He tells the prophet in response what he's going to do, and it's unbelievable. Look among the nations, exclamation point. Observe, exclamation point. Be astonished, exclamation point. Wonder. These are all plural imperatives which speak of the prophet and the people. And the word your in verse 5 twice is plural, prophet and the people. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans. Now, this was prophesied in Isaiah 39:6. The term Chaldeans can be a title for a group of wise men, like in Daniel 2:2, or it's a racial group that made up the Neo-Babylonian Empire. They were Semites, and they came from the south and overthrew everybody. Okay? They are going to be, they're a godless people, a pagan people, a cruel people, but they're going to be used as an instrument of God's judgment on Judah, just as the Assyrians were an instrument of God's judgment on the northern 10 tribes of Israel. Okay? But God's in control of history. That's what God's trying to say. My people have become perverted, and I'm going to chastise them with this godless nation. Boy, it was hard for the prophet to imagine. It really was. Now, look at this, verse 7. They are dreaded and feared, and their justice and authority originate with themselves. They are humanistic-oriented people. They look to themselves for their own power and purpose, and that's what it's talking about here. Their horses are swifter than leopards. That's the same kind of metaphor used in Daniel. They are keener than wolves in the evening. Now, we'll see Zephaniah 3:3. These verses speak of the military might and speed of the Babylonian army. I want to tell you, Syria fell almost overnight. So will Babylon, by the way. Now, the horsemen came galloping. This is used in Deuteronomy 28:49 and following for the pride of the Assyrians. And the same allusion is here. They gallop like, boy, I'm in control of my own destiny. We're the mightiest military machine in the world. And they were, by the will of God. Now, notice in verse 9, the second part, very difficult thing in Hebrew. Their horde of faces moves forward. Now, there are two possibilities in this Hebrew text here. One is the idea that their greed forces them on, or possibly, as the east wind destroys the crops before it, so this army destroys nations and cities before it. Now, one of those is probably what it is. It says, like the sand, there are so many of them. They mock at kings. The ease of their military conquest is just unbelievable. They heap up rubble to capture it, in verse 10. That's the idea of a siege wall against these cities. And then they sweep through like the wind and pass on. But they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. Now, here's the idea of their worldly power, their military machine. And God said, I want you to tell you, they're going to reap what they sow. Friends, just as Judas was responsible for his own actions, though God knew what he'd do, this nation that's going to be God's instrument of judgment is responsible for their acts, and they will stand before God. If one thing the Bible teaches is, we are responsible for our own acts. And that's what it's saying right here. Same thing is said of Assyria, Isaiah 10, 12 through 14. Her arrogance and pride, she will pay a price for, and certainly she does. Now, in verse 12 and following is the prophet's response to God's response. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord? Now, O Lord's the word Yahweh. It's the Hebrew verb to be from Exodus 3:14. I think it should be translated the ever-living God or the only living God. And that's why the word everlasting is a play on the prophet calling God Yahweh. And then notice he says, my God, my Holy One. Now, the idea of a Holy One here, God didn't look like he was holy because his people had been devastated. It looked like he was not in control. And there was wickedness everywhere, inside his own people and in the world. But he is the Holy One, and he's going to work things out. But notice that personal pronoun, my God, my Holy One. Boy, now that's personal faith. That's biblical faith. Then finally it clues, we will not die. Well, is that a question or an affirmation? Well, it seems to be connected with God's covenant promises and messianic promises to the nation of Judah. If the nation of Judah goes into captivity and loses itself in history, how is God going to fulfill his promises? So the prophet says, we cannot die, can we? You can't cut us off, can you? And yet God, even though it maligned his own name and caused the other nations to ridicule him, was ready to let his own people be taken captive that they might turn back to him in faith. Now, notice where it says, O rock, there in verse 12. Now, rock is a word that speaks of the unchanging certainty and protection and power of God. Let me give you a few references. Deuteronomy 32:4, 15, 18, 30, and 31, used several times in that chapter. Psalms 18:1 and 2 and 31, and Isaiah 26:4 and 30:29. O rock, is a name for God. Provide water in the wilderness from the rock. God is my fortress and strength. I tell you, it's a beautiful metaphor. Y'all look it up. It'll just bless your life. Now, notice in verse 13, thine eyes are too pure to approve evil. It's the word look on with the ideal of pleasure. The same thing as the word with favor here. Two different Hebrew words for favor, but they mean the same thing. What the prophet's saying is, God, how can you do this? I know your people are wicked, but God, they're so wicked. They don't even know you. How can you do this? And look at latter part of verse 13. Those more righteous than they. Now, Israel was wicked, but she's not that wicked. Wait a minute now. The reason is because to whom much is given, much is required. Israel was more wicked because she was sinning in the presence of great light. And I think that's what the unpardonable sin is, rejecting God in the presence of great light. I think their responsibility was far, far beyond that of the Assyrians or Babylonians because they did know God. And that's true of us in the church too. To whom much is given, much is required. Now, let's see. Okay, verse 14. Why hast thou made men like a fish of the sea? See the word hook and the word nets and all that in verses 14, 15, and 16? They sacrifice to their net. They burn incense to their fishing net. Now, one of two things here. We have many reliefs from the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And the chief deity is Marduk. Many of these pictures have Marduk pulling a fishing net full of captured enemies. So maybe this is, number one, a sacrifice to their military machine. Some people do that. Or two, a sacrifice to their deity for empowering their military machine. Sometimes we really think that our own nation's military is God's military. Not so. Verse 17 is the final question of discouragement for the prophet. Now, the prophet's going to say in chapter 2, verse 1, I know you're going to answer me, God, and I'm going to go and watch and wait until you answer me. He didn't want to speak his own mind. He wanted a word from the Lord, and he's going to wait for it, and he's going to get it. Now, in chapter 2, verses 2 through 5, God is going to respond. The Lord answered and said to me, record this vision and inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. Well, that's kind of a Hebrew idiom. He'd explain it. Write it very clearly in large letters, put it in a public place so that someone just running by will be able to notice it and read it. That's the idea here. Now, I think it may be verse 4 that we're talking about. Verse 4 is a tremendous spiritual truth that's quoted 3 times in the New Testament. Romans 1:7, Galatians 3:11, Hebrews 10:38. It is the center pillar of Paul's discussion of justification by faith. Woo, it's a biggie. Maybe that's what he's talking about. Placard this. In verse 3, it hastens toward its goal. Now, that's the word pants, okay? Pants toward its goal. What goal is that? Well, God is going to bring judgment to this godless nation as he's brought judgment to his own people. I think of Longfellow's poem, Retribution. Listen to this. Though the mills of God grind slowly, they grind exceedingly small. Though the patience he stands waiting, with exactness grinds he all. It's coming. God is going to give to each man according to his deeds if we're not covered by the blood of Jesus Christ. Now, notice it says it will certainly come, it will not delay. What? Judgment for some, promise and hope for others. Oh, friend, I hope you know Jesus. I hope you know him. Verse 4, behold, as the proud one. This means puffed up. It's used in the Bible several times for hemorrhoids. You might want to see Deuteronomy 28:27 and 1 Samuel 5, 6, 9, and 12. It's used here. His soul is not right within him. Right, meaning the standard, is deviated. But the righteous will live by his faith. Now, the word faith is the Hebrew word amen, a derivative of it, form of it. It means to be firm or to be sure. It's primarily used of the faithfulness of God. But the faithfulness of God has given us a faithful message about himself. And if man will respond by faith to the faithful God, God will make that man faithful. So the idea is that justification by faith is just God counting sinners right is not really accurate. It's true to a point, it's just not the whole truth. God counts us as right in Jesus Christ, And then God tries to make us like Jesus Christ or bring us into faithfulness. And that's the flow. It's not just a legal thing. It's a lifestyle change, a lifestyle a motive to Christ-likeness. And we've got to see that or we pervert the New Testament doctrine of justification by faith. There is a pronouncement. There is a transfer of righteousness. There is an imputedness from Jesus to us. But that is not just legal. It works toward character, too. Now, this is one of those great passages. It probably should be translated, the just shall live by his faithfulness. That's what the word primarily means in the Old Testament, faithfulness. Paul uses this over and over. It's a key verse. It's Luther's great promise. Okay? Now, look at verse 5. Furthermore, the wine betrays the haughty man. Well, this may be a verse that says don't drink too much, and most military conquerors do. Alexander the Great's a good example. Many others. Or maybe it's saying military victory, some kind, becomes an intoxicant all of itself. Oh, the pride of man. Ho, ho, ho. Notice the word Sheol, which is the same as the New Testament Hades. It's the holding place of the dead, okay? Verse 5 continues a description of the Chaldean military machine. I want you to know it's greed and pride make them cruel masters. Now look at verse 6 and following. Here's a series of laments on the fall of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Will not all of these take up a taunt song against him? And this is a predictive prophecy of the nations who he subdued and sent into exile and been so cruel to are going to really laugh and sing when Babylon gets theirs. And boy, they will under Cyrus. Notice where it says, you'll become the plunder for them, verse 7. And it's a series of woes, very shocking woes. Notice it says, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. This seems to be a reference to destroying nations, that kind of thing. Notice by cutting off peoples in verse 10, that's the idea of national deportation, which the Assyrians practiced and also the Babylonians. Notice verse 11, the Babylonian Empire will fall. And what a crash is it going to be, you know. Look at verse 12. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed. Apparently Nebuchadnezzar was world famous for his tremendous building projects, but he built it with slave labor. And friends, I want to tell you, the site of Babylon today is a whistle stop on a railroad train for only archaeologists to get off of. Destroyed and never re-inhabited. Now, notice where it says, verse 13, the first two verses, really seems to emphasize again the city of Babylon will be destroyed. Verse 14 talks about the coming day of the Lord, as does verse 20. In verse 15, we have the greed and treachery toward the surrounding peoples recorded again. In verse 16, we have an unusual thing. Mine has exposed your own nakedness, but the literal is show yourself uncircumcised. It again speaks of God's judgment. This little metaphor of the cup is in the right hand of the Lord. The cup in the Old Testament is a sign of God's judgment or man's destiny. We see it in the life of Jesus Christ, who said, Lord, let this cup pass from me, in Psalm 75:8, and then Mark 14:35. Jesus is the one that drank the judgment of men, drank the dregs of human judgment, and gave man his righteousness. We gave him our sin. He gave us his life. What a trade. Now, verse 17 is one example of the power and destruction of the Babylonian army. Verses 18 and following, some say that 17 possibly relates to 18 with the cedars of Lebanon being used to make idols or to make temples. And here the folly of idolatry is mentioned and the affirmation that God is in control of history. Now in chapter 3 we have this great anthem of praise to the God who is in control of history. And much of this deals with allusions from the Exodus period. Now, King James Version and Martin Luther translate this chapter mostly in the past tense. But the Septuagint uses the future tense and the aorist tense, while the Vulgate uses the perfect tense and the future tense. So it's a real problem about how to translate these words. Hebrew has two verbal forms, and they're very fluid, perfect and imperfect. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigneo. Now this is a musical term. It means to reel or to be drunk or to err. A musical term, much like verse 19 of this third chapter, that tells that Habakkuk, along with the use of the word Selah, was a very musically trained person, probably part of the temple choir. We're just not certain. Notice the word Lord in verse 2 is Yahweh, the covenant name for God. It's in all caps. I have heard the report about thee, and I fear. This is reverence, respect. O Lord, revive. That means bring back to life thy work in the midst of years. What he's saying is, do it again, God. As we pray for revival to sweep our country as it did during the frontier period, we're praying for God to do it again. That's what Habakkuk is praying for. God, please, God, do it again. Now, in verse 3, we have Teman, which is basically for south. It means south, and it's the nation of Edom. And then we have Mount Paran. Now, some have wondered what this means. Well, it seems to be an allusion of God who lived on Mount Sinai, or that's where he met the nation of Israel. He's coming to the mountain that's between Edom and Sinai, and then he's coming into Edom to deliver his people. It's kind of like God using the top of the mountain as a stepping stone to come and deliver his people. That's what it seems to be. The word Selah is used here the first time. It seems to mean to lift up in Hebrew, though the derivation is certainly obscure. The Septuagint translates it as interlude, and that may be true. It's some kind of musical or deal or about how to speak the words or say it to music. Notice the idea in verse 4, the radiance of the sunlight. I think that's speaking about the Shekinah glory of God. You know, we'll see Psalms 104, 2, the radiance and brightness and power. In verse 5, the words pestilence and plagues, we have learned from other archaeological discoveries, are sometimes a name for a demon. How it's used here, we're not certain. Notice it mentioned his ways are everlasting. The mountains and hills are used as metaphors of his permanence, and yet, even they're going to fall. And yet here we have God relating somehow to these two mountains mentioned in verse 3. Notice that the tents of Cushan and Midian, possibly this refers to the tribes that the nation of Israel encountered along their trek through the wilderness wandering periods. And then in verse 8, did the Lord rage against the rivers? This seems to be referring to his deliverance of the children through the Red Sea, and through the Jordan River both. And it's an allusion to that. Verses 8 through 15 are God using natural means to bring about supernatural salvation. Notice, if you would, all the allusions through. Look at verse 11. Sun and moon stood in their places. Friends, the sun and the moon don't have an independent existence. They're not separate gods that guide our lives. Horoscopes are just a bunch of baloney, pure baloney. They're even based on a Ptolemaic view of the universe. It's even not true, we know today. Friends, God is the controller of heavenly bodies. You don't have to worry about if your star lines up or doesn't line up. You know God, it's going to be all right. You don't know him. I don't care if you have all the powers of heaven lined up. You won't make any difference. At the radiance of thy gleaming spear. This word gleaming is only used here in Deuteronomy 32, 40 through 42, which deals with this same period of Exodus. Now, let's see. In verse 16, this inward parts trembled. I was nervous. I heard this message and I went faint. That's what happened to Daniel, too. The message overpowered him. Daniel 8, 17, 18, 27, Daniel 10, 7 through 10, and 15 through 19. The message was too much for him. This prophet true. The idea about decay entering my bones, this is a metaphor for losing of strength, okay? Then it concludes. Look at verse 18 and 19. Yet I will exult in the Lord. I'll rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet. Well, hinds are sure-footed deers that jump on the high places. And so what it talks about is God's stability and protection and guidance and trust and empowering makes me walk in high places for the choir director on my stringed instruments. And there again, we think that possibly a choir director. You know, that's what I thought about this, how the nation must have felt with all the turmoil that was going on. The time Habakkuk wrote, Jeremiah was writing, some of the other prophets are Nahum, Zephaniah, Obadiah. And you know, I wrote in the corner of my Bible, when faith is swept off her feet, she finds that she has wings. That's from Kyle Yates. But until we're put to the test, we never know. Israel was judged because of their sin. But God loved them. He's a father that disciplined his children to bring the children back to the father, even though it really made the name of God look bad among the heathen. God did it because of his love. And God won't let us get too far. If we get away, he's going to do something. He's going to say, that's far enough, son. He will not let us go. He'll deal with us. But the other side is true. in the midst of the discipline of God. It is so hard. You ought to read the book of Hebrews chapter 12, where it talks about God's discipline. God loved these people, but it's important that they had a relationship with Him, not a ritual, not a liturgy, but a relationship. That's what we need. We don't need rules. Rules are good in their place. Liturgy is good in its place. Ritual is good in its place, but it will never take the place of relationship. That heartfelt biblical faith that comes to God and cries to Him in pain, that sings to Him in joy, that comes to Him with problems. That's what the Bible's all about. It's a story of God dealing with nations and individuals. It shows us how He works with people and promises us that if we'll respond to Him by faith with openness and trust, that He'll work with us in that same way. Habakkuk really questions God. Habakkuk is one of those books where you know it's okay to question God. Like Jeremiah, it's okay to say, God, what's the matter? What's the deal? It's okay to work through our doubts to greater faith. Chapter 3 is an affirmation that God is in control of history, that He will do it again, and that we need to patiently wait for Him to come. Oh, friends, wait for Him. Have patience with Him. He loves you. He's coming. He's never been late. Don't give up. Hang in there. I'll see you same time, same place next week. God bless you.